Good evening, and welcome to today's program, co-sponsored by the Commonwealth Club of California and the Exploratorium. The Commonwealth Club, founded in 1903, is the nation's oldest and largest public affairs forum. The Exploratorium is a San Francisco-based collage of hundreds of science, art, and human perception exhibits, as well as a leader in the movement to promote museums as educational centers. I am Mary Miller, science producer at the Exploratorium and your moderator for tonight. We also welcome our listeners on the radio. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guest, Dr. Stephen Chu. Dr. Chu is a renowned research scientist and the director of the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory at UC Berkeley. He shared the Nobel Prize in 1997 for the development of methods to cool and trap atoms with laser light. He's respected internationally for his work in atomic physics, laser spectroscopy, biophysics, and polymer physics. Dr. Chu received bachelor's degrees in mathematics and physics from the University of Rochester and a PhD from UC Berkeley. He worked at Bell Laboratories from 1978 to 1987, and it was there that Dr. Chu did the research that would be recognized with a Nobel Prize, which he received at the tender age of 49. After Bell, Dr. Chu was a professor at Stanford, where he helped establish BioX, a major cross-disciplinary center of biology, physics, engineering, chemistry, and computer science. He was tapped to run Lawrence Berkeley Lab a year ago, where a major focus of his attention has been on the growing international crisis of energy consumption and its role in climate change. Dr. Chu will begin with some opening remarks, and then I will be in conversation with him. Please welcome Dr. Stephen Chu.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and I have to warn you, as a physicist, I'm not accustomed to talking without PowerPoint slides. And so if I stumble, it's because I'm not used to giving these type of talks. I want you to think about the kind of times we live in today. We really live in a magical world. With a flick of a switch, we can get 10 horses popping out of the wall and come to our bidding to clean a carpet, or 100 horses or more to take us to the grocery store, or we can fly across the country under the tug of 100,000 horses. We have the technology, and there is an economic possibility to elevate the living conditions of much of humanity to the heights that the wealthiest of the Roman emperors could never dream of. And we really never had it so good. And so what has made all of this possible? It's energy. It's our ability to find, use, exploit energy. And we've become very good at it. Since 1970, our use of energy in the world has doubled, and in the next 20 years, it is expected to triple. The extraction of oil, our most precious energy source, and actually the source of most of our plastics and fertilizer, is expected to peak sometime between 5 and 30 years from now, and most of it will be gone by the end of this century. So it's ironic what took hundreds of millions of years to create this fossil fuel will be consumed pretty much in 200 years, and the bulk of it within less than 150 years. And natural gas will follow. There are other forms of fossil fuel, like coal, that could last hundreds of years, but there's a catch. There's a cost of keeping the equivalent of literally a billion horses working 24/7, 365 days a year. It's the modern equivalent of keeping the stables clean. So what is that? It's the growing realization that the Earth is warming up due to carbon dioxide emissions. And there's an overwhelming consensus about that. The evidence so far is direct measurements the Earth has warmed up by a little over a degree Fahrenheit since 1860, most of it in the last 50 years. And since 1860, 19 of the 20th warmest years have occurred since 1980. And the warmest 11 years have occurred all since 1990. So what are some of the consequences of global warming? Well, we are witnessing the melting of Antarctica and the Greenland ice packs, and the sea level is rising. Glaciers are retreating. Glacier National Park will soon have to be renamed Non-Glacier National Park. evaporation and rainfall are increasing. That's because, well, higher temperature, you evaporate more water, and it's got to come down somewhere. But we're also expecting and seeing more violent storms. Second, insurers. Those are insurers who insure insurance companies just in case there's a major catastrophe, are very worried. And the world's second largest reinsurer, Swiss Re, has actually issued a warning in March 2005 that because of the cost of natural disasters, probably aggravated by global warming, these costs are threatening to spiral out of control. There are other evidence. Corals around the world are bleaching. The higher temperature in the oceans actually cause the microorganisms in the calcium to die, and then they just have a calcium skeleton left, and so on. So what are the predictions of continued global warming? Well, first, I have to say something about a quote that the greatest American philosopher of the 20th century, Yogi Berra, was reputed to have said. Predictions are hard to make, especially about the future. And with that caveat, here are some predictions. In addition to average temperature rises, the extremes of hot and cold will increase. Average precipitation will increase, and so will storms, floods, and wildfires. There's going to be property loss from sea level rise, as well as new beachfront property. So you can buy property in mid-Florida cheap, and maybe 50 years from now, it'll be worth a lot. The productivity of farms could be severely affected. For example, with a 2 times rise in the emission of carbon since pre-industrial ages, and we're halfway there, the temperature of the Midwest of the United States is projected to increase by about 6 to 8 degrees Fahrenheit, and a 20 to 30% decrease in the soil moisture in the months June to August. So the great grain belt of the Midwest is in peril as well. Deaths due to heat spells in the summer months are increasing, and I think many of you may remember in August of 2003, France attributed 3,000 deaths to a 2-week heat wave at that time. The melting of polar ice caps not only caused the oceans to rise, and much of the populated world lives within a few meters of the ocean, but something else is happening, and that is the oceans are getting less salty, especially in the northern hemisphere. There's another prediction which is much less certain, and that is that the Gulf Stream will be affected and could turn south. If the Gulf Stream turns south, northern Europe will be a lot colder. London is at the same latitude as Calgary, Canada. For those of you who don't know where Calgary, Canada is, in the winter, temperatures go down to minus 35 C. So I would say among America's most serious concerns, you could consider national security, which is now intimately tied to energy security and access to energy, the long-term economic competitiveness of the United States, and the dangers of global warming. And I believe that this energy issue is at the center of all of these concerns, and thus I think it's the single most important problem, societal problem, that science has to solve. If you compare it to other things we invest heavily in, for example, investments in medicine, cures of heart disease, stroke, cancer, if we don't solve those problems, it would be tragic, but life will go on as we know it. If we don't solve this problem, life could really change. And if you look at what's going on, what can we do about it? Unfortunately, there appear to be no magic bullets to solve this problem. And for that reason, we have to develop a diversified portfolio of investigation. Because of global warming, I'm terribly afraid that investments, which are now being planned for conventional coal-burning plants, will be a problem. There is a possibility of carbon sequestration. That means you take the coal, you turn it into some other alternate fuel, ultimately something like hydrogen, which when you burn creates water, and you take all of the carbon byproducts, the carbon dioxide, and you stuff it under the ground under permanent storage. If we can do this, that would be fine. But that's not a proven technology yet. What are some of the other possibilities? Well, there's fusion, and we have been investing and will continue to invest heavily in fusion, but even those working on it can't really promise that it's going to have commercial success within the next 20, 30, 50 years. So we can't put all our eggs in that basket. There's fission, but there are some concerns with fission, notably long-term waste storage and the potential proliferation of nuclear weapons. Despite these issues, I think we have to take a second look, especially if we can develop technologies that would greatly reduce the production of radioactive waste and greatly, by changing these long-lived isotopes into shorter-lived isotopes, there are projections that it could perhaps be decreased by a factor of 100. I think it's worth looking at, especially given the alternatives. Beyond nuclear energy, our most likely option is solar energy. And when you think of solar, you think of solar cells. But you should also think of wind and hydroelectric and the rest of it. The trouble with solar cells is that we need about a factor of 5 to 10, depending on who you talk to, for it to be really large-scale deployable. Wind has actually made incredible strides. I couldn't believe in the last 10 years how efficient it has gotten. But there are limited wind resources, and it's not a dependent energy on coal source of energy. So ultimately, we would have to also figure out how to convert electricity into some storable energy, ideally some sort of chemical energy that you can then produce energy on demand. There's another approach, and that is to try to mimic nature. For billions of years, photosynthesis has turned the sun's energy in combination with water and carbon dioxide as a raw ingredient into some chemical fuel. The trouble with this chemical fuel is it's pretty low-grade chemical fuel. It's mostly in the form of cellulose. Now, because of the remarkable strides in molecular biology, there is the ability to improve upon these plants, make them self-fertilizing. We have plants that are fertilizing. They're like soybeans, legumes, and we used to rotate crops, but we've gone away from that. We now use oil to turn to ammonia to make nitrogen-based fertilizers. But we can actually graft on, if you will, the ability to fix nitrogen to make fertilizer on the same plant that grows essentially like a weed without much water very quickly. Then there's the second part of that problem is to turn the cellulose into energy in a much more efficient way than we do now. Again, nature has led the way. If you look inside the gut of a termite, termites eat cellulose. In fact, unfortunately, that's most of what they eat. When we eat cellulose, this is good for our large intestines, keeps us healthy, but we don't use it as fuel. The poor termites got to turn this into fuel, and so they have developed a symbiotic relationship with a community of bacteria that turn cellulose into chemical fuel. And there's a little carrying charge that the microorganisms charge. The bottom of the swamp's the same thing. All the bio waste in the bottom of the swamp turns into methane, natural gas. In fact, that's how natural gas was discovered. And so we have the ability, I believe, to look at these microorganisms and improve upon them, alter them, and make them very efficient producers of energy for us. I know it sounds horrible, but given the choices, I'd rather, we've domesticated cows and pigs and sheep, so I think we should domesticate bacteria. So having told all of this, I can now tell you why I'm here, and mostly why I decided to leave a very wonderful place, Stanford University, and a very rich place, to become director of Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory and to join University of California. In large part, the reason for doing that has to do with the opportunity that this lab has many of the pieces that can address this problem. Just as background information, the Berkeley Lab is on a hill overlooking Berkeley, University of California at Berkeley, and it's run by the University of California on behalf of the Department of Energy. It has a budget of approximately $500 million a year. There's 3,800 employees, of which about a third of them are graduate students, undergraduate students, postdocs, and professors in the UC system. So it's very much integrated into the teaching and research mission of the University of California. There's no classified work done there, and it's a very distinguished lab. There are, of the 14 Nobel laureates in the University of California, Berkeley, 10 of them were employees of the lab, and 8 of them did their Nobel Prize winning work at the laboratory. Currently, there are, and I think there's 11th and possibly 12th on the way, for sure 11. There are currently 59 employees in the lab that are members of the National Academy of Sciences, the most distinguished body in the sciences in the United States. Just to give you a baseline, that's approximately 3% of all the members. And so for that reason, the Berkeley Lab is really considered a national treasure on the par with the great research institutions of this country. Now, at the Berkeley Lab, this energy challenge is beginning to capture the imagination of our best scientists. And we're now mounting a major multidisciplinary initiative to create sustainable, carbon-neutral energy. We have all the pieces. We have great strengths in physics, biology, chemistry, computational sciences. We have world-class facilities, like one of the most productive synchrotron storage rings in the world, the largest non-classified Department of Energy supercomputer in the United States. A new nanotechnology facility is under construction that will be part of a material science complex, which is arguably, or not even, it's not even, it's a slam dunk. I think it's the best material science laboratory in the National Lab complex. And so this laboratory is capable of attacking the energy problem, reminiscent of the way Bell Labs attacked the problem in the late 30s and early 40s. During that time, they had progressed from ladies putting wires into walls to make phone connections, to mechanical relays, to vacuum tubes as electronic switches. But the vacuum tube technology was limited. You could see how it scales. There were going to be reliability issues, speed issues, the whole works. And so they decided in the late 30s, early 40s, that they needed to develop a totally different kind of electronic switch, perhaps a condensed matter, a solid state switch. And they set about to invent a transistor. But they didn't have a lot of the science and technology for the, quote, invention of the transistor, and they couldn't take an Edisonian approach. They had to develop new breakthroughs in material science to produce highly purified silicon and germanium. They had to understand when you put in doping, these are impurities into this material in a way that is in a controlled way that can change the electronic properties of these materials, the surface characterization of these materials, the underlying theoretical physics of this, all had to be done. And so they marched off and did this. They engaged their best and brightest scientists, and they all got excited about this. And what came out, not only was the invention of the transistor, it was also the underpinnings that was the basis of all of the semiconductor technology for the next 50 years. And it also got three Nobel Prizes. But it was much more than that. We've been still reaping the benefits of this incredible breakthrough in understanding of solid-state electronics. So one of my hopes is that these very rapidly advancing areas in science, in particular molecular biology, nanotechnology, will allow the creation of new technologies that would then transform the energy landscape. And so we at Berkeley Lab are looking at some of the avenues of research I described above, carbon sequestration and radioactive waste, but we're also now beginning to look at, in addition to totally radically solar cells based on nanotechnology, the efficient conversion of electricity into chemical fuel and these biological approaches that I talked about, including looking at how termites make, or not the termites, but the bacteria in the termites make energy. So we're all very excited about this. It's a great opportunity. I'm confident that there's going to be really great science that will come out of it, maybe a few more Nobel Prizes. And in addition, we hope to help save the world. With that, I thank you.
Our thanks to Dr. Stephen Chu, Nobel laureate for physics in 1997 and director of the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory, National Laboratory, for his remarks. I'm Mary Miller, science producer at the Exploratorium, and we will now talk further with Dr. Chu. I really appreciate that overview, and I'm considering that this is extremely important, the most important problem that scientists and society faces. Are you frustrated by the lack of urgency and sometimes even acknowledgement in Washington? I imagine you spend a lot of time talking to lawmakers. Are you having to convince them of this? Or what's the climate of climate change in Washington?
The climate's changing rapidly. And I'm optimistic that things are changing rapidly. And I think in this business, you have to be optimistic. So I think there's a real growing momentum regarding this. Many more people are speaking out. Many of the people in the executive and legislative branches of the government are appreciating just how important this is and realizing that it's something that science followed by technology really has to solve.
So there's maybe a lot behind the scenes happening that we don't necessarily see when we read the New York Times.
Yes.
This is a question from the audience. Do you feel that the government spends enough money on energy issues? If not, what would be your recommendation?
I have to be careful. I am an employee of the Department of Energy. No, I actually would hope that the government would spend more on energy, especially looking at the new solutions. As an optimist, I think because of the very rapid developments in the areas I talked about, molecular biology and a new field called synthetic biology, also the nanotechnology, there's a real hope. I think scientists, by their nature, have to be optimistic. I think investments like this are actually relatively small compared to the overall energy budget. It's just a very, very small part of it. And it could then really transform the way we deal with this. I should also emphasize in the same breath that, although I didn't stress, I did mention very briefly that energy efficiency and conservation is also very important for two reasons. First, it buys time. And the amount of energy efficiency can be easily a factor of 2 to 4 without really altering dramatically our lifestyle. It buys time, and it also adjusts the bar of what we have to come up with in the end. So it's really a combination of using energy wisely. Maybe we don't really need 10 horses to clean our carpet or 250 horses to go to the market. But in addition to that, so we have a new adjusted bar, and then it makes it a lot easier. And some of the solutions I talked about, if you alter things by factors of 2, they become economically viable much sooner.
So Jimmy Carter was really ahead of his time talking about people wearing sweaters at home instead of,
I wasn't thinking of wearing sweaters. Just do a lot more exercise, keep your metabolism up. No, seriously, I think by not changing your lifestyle, even having California has led the way on this since the late 70s. It was actually the Berkeley Lab, I have to say, Art Rosenfeld, who was a high energy physicist, in that energy crisis, stopped doing high energy physics, said, I'm going to devote my energies to making some contribution towards energy efficiency. And through his efforts, through efforts of his colleagues, he really changed the landscape in California since the late mid-1970s to 2000. The consumption of electricity per capita in California has been flat. The rest of the country has gone up by 50%. Okay, and it's really Art Rosenfeld really started this. And I should also add that the economy didn't appear to have suffered. So I think you can decouple, energy use from the health of the economy. Now, when I talked to Art about this recently, I said, well, it's great, but, there was a lot of low-hanging fruit. He says, Steve, it wasn't low-hanging fruit. It was fruit on the ground.
So this is another question from the audience. You had mentioned this term carbon neutral energy source, and I've also heard you talk about turning our excess agriculture into fuels that can possibly be burned in cars. How soon do you think? Do you think it'll be within 20 years that we'll be able to buy these carbon neutral biofuels?
And if you live in Brazil, you can buy it now. The cost of running your car on ethanol in Brazil is half the cost of gasoline. Now, Brazil has certain advantages. They can grow sugarcane. They have 3 crops a year. They have lots of water. And they have now cars in Brazil that are called flex cars. You flick a switch, you can run it on ethanol. You flick the switch the other way, you run it on gasoline. So these things exist now. So you can use Brazil as an existence proof of what you can do. Now, in the United States, we don't have three growing seasons. We have 1.5 growing seasons. And so you're going to have to grow better, redesign plants to take advantage of what we do have. But it sets the stage for what you need to do in order to, let's say, convert a third or half the arable land in the United States into growing energy instead of food. Now, the good news is our agricultural industry is awesome. It produces far more than what we need. And because of the World Trade Organization and other international agreements, we can no longer put our subsidized crops on the open market. So there's this huge engine, and it needs to be fed, so to speak. We spend over $1 billion. It ranges from $1 billion to $3.8 billion subsidizing U.S. farmers to grow corn for ethanol. But it's essentially a negative in terms of how much energy you put into growing the corn versus how much energy you extract to run your car. So I think there's a great opportunity to do research in growing the right plants and convert them into ethanol or methanol. And we can then use this agricultural engine that we have.
Mm-hmm. So another question from the audience. With a new movement worldwide to build fission nuclear power plants, what are the possibilities in Japan, Europe, and especially here at Lawrence Berkeley Lab for fusion research? Is Congress adequately funding fusion in a hydrogen-based economy?
Well, as many of you know, there was approved now an international consortium that will build a fusion reactor in southern France, and it's a big project. The hope is that it's a research reactor, and the hope is that that research reactor will actually get what we call break-even. That means you get all your magnets going, you get the plasma in there, it's a nice, hot, steamy plasma, it's all sitting there, and then you inject more energy into it, and fusion starts to occur, and the fusion energy you get out equals the energy you injected in. It's not wall plug efficiency. And then you have to do much better than that in order to have a commercial reactor. So the hope is that within the next decade and a half or 2 decades, we can get this thing running. So that puts the time scale on this. And that's what I said. Commercial fusion is at least 3 or 4 decades away. Mm-hmm. And so we've got to look now for other, quite frankly, lower tech alternatives.
Mm-hmm. I actually like to change gears here and talk a little bit about your background. You grew up near Brooklyn, one of 3 kids of a first generation of Chinese immigrants. It's hard to imagine, but I heard that you were actually the black sheep in your family.
I was not only a black sheep of my immediate family, I was a black sheep of my family and all the extended family, which include 2 other families.
So you'll have to explain yourself here because you won a Nobel Prize. So.
Yeah, now I'm in the middle rungs. let's see. I have 2 other brothers. One brother has a PhD in physics and molecular biology and an MD. The other brother has a PhD, which he got when he was 21. I got a law degree at Harvard and became the managing partner of a major law firm in Los Angeles, I think before he was 40, and is probably one of the highest paid intellectual property rights attorneys in the country. So I'm a black sheep. and unfortunately, all but 3 of the extended family have multiple either MD, PhDs or something like that. There's a few of us who've only had 1 PhD or MD. And it's worse than that. With Asian families, Chinese families especially, they're always comparing kids, like Jewish families.
So didn't winning the Nobel Prize redeem you? How come you're just in the middle rungs? And now you're director of a national lab.
Oh, that doesn't count for anything. it redeemed me in some of my family's eyes, not my mother's eyes. She still can't figure out why my older brother, the oldest brother, who is the apple in the eye, he's actually the best one in terms of filial duty. He's the one with the most degrees. And so my mother, who's getting along in the years, but she's still trying to figure out, why didn't Gilbert get the Nobel Prize? Why did Stephen get the Nobel Prize? And so she's finally come to the solution. She's figured Well, Stephen must be better in the politics of getting something like that. So you can't win.
You know, I think sometimes it's nice to be the underdog because less is expected of you, and you can only go up, which you've obviously done.
Yeah, there's some truth to that, but it's not that the bar wasn't set that low. My father used to lecture us when we were little. I remember the second grade, he said, "Okay, boys, remember, don't get married until after you get your PhD."
What got you interested in physics? I understand you like to tinker around with erector sets and homemade rockets, and you know, you were a great experimentalist as a child.
Well, I wouldn't say a great experimentalist. I set the kitchen table on fire when I was trying to make these little, essentially matchstick rockets. I set the field behind our house on fire. So I was punished for that. But my older brother was the leader. I think looking back on what I did and what my siblings did is I actually had incredibly understanding parents. They would allow me to build these erector sets, which is not pre-programmed. You only could build, let's say, with Legos, a ship or something like that. They're just pieces of metal and screws. So you could do whatever you want, but there's no template, really. And so some of the things that I was building would take days. And we weren't that rich. My father was a professor at Brooklyn Polytech, and so we had a very small house. All three of us lived in one bedroom, and so I would build this stuff in the living room. And so these things would start to erect in the living room, and she didn't make me clean it up at night. So I think, you know, they put up with a certain level of, he's doing the right thing, leave him alone.
That's good. That's a good lesson for parents out there, to let your kids make a mess.
Right.
Over several days.
And the other thing I have to say is I had a succession of really great teachers. Mm-hmm. In high school, I had a wonderful physics teacher for 2 years, really, truly inspirational. In fact, he got national prizes for his teaching. I went to college. I had a great set of teachers there and a great thesis advisor when I was at Berkeley.
Mm-hmm. So I actually want to ask you that because I know you're a product of public school education, and you went to University of Rochester, which is not an Ivy League school. But I think anyone would argue that you've had a brilliant career in science and continue to have a brilliant career. Do you have advice for parents and kids about what it takes to be successful as a scientist beyond building erector sets in the living room?
Right. Well, I mean, I applied to Princeton and Yale. They rejected me, and I went to Rochester. I was a bit more rebellious than my older brother, and so if there are certain things I didn't want to study, I would say, okay, wouldn't study them. And so I graduated with an A-minus average. It was a great high school, Garden City, and so it was maybe in the top 8%. And I think the top 5%, you all go to Ivy League schools, but that was at the cusp. And so I didn't get in. It was probably the best thing that happened to me. When I went to Rochester, first, had I gone to Princeton, there's lots of smart people, and I don't know how I would have reacted to this intense competition. Whereas when I went to Rochester, I didn't know how I would do there, but within a half a year, it became clear I was going to do all right. In fact, I very soon became a teacher's pet, if you will, and was adopted by a few professors, both in the mathematics department and physics department. That went a long way to boosting my self-confidence, having been so severely undermined in my childhood. And so when I went to Berkeley after Rochester, again, I didn't know because, you know, in those days, Berkeley was really the best physics department in the world. And going to Berkeley, I said, okay, the best and the brightest from Caltech and MIT and Harvard and Stanford and so on would go there. And how would I do? And first I found out that I had a great education in Rochester. It began to dawn on me because my classmates began to ask me how to do their homework problems. And then by then I also had self-confidence. So, okay, you know, I can figure this stuff out. So it was, so to parents who feel that the world has caved in, or your children will feel the world's caved in because you didn't get into the most prestigious school possible, it's not so bad. Right? and the American educational system is incredibly elastic.
In physics, there are theorists and there are experimentalists. How did you choose what kind of physics you would do? Do you think that some minds are just better suited to one than the other?
Well, when I was in Rochester, I thought I was going to be a theorist, theoretical physicist. I was a math major and a physics major. And when I went to Berkeley, I also thought I was going to be a theorist. And my advisor actually gave me a theoretical problem. But my heart wasn't really in it, and he was very patient, so every two or three weeks he'd say, how are you doing with this problem? And little did he know, I was sneaking down into the lab and putting little things together and playing. I showed him one of my experiments, but finally I said, you know, I think I really want to be an experimentalist. The reason why I thought I wanted to be a theorist was misguided. When you take a traditional physics education, all the great physicists that you hear about are theorists. And it took me a while to appreciate that physics in its heart and soul is an experimental science, and for that reason, the majority of the people who get Nobel Prizes in physics are experimentalists. You hear about Einstein, you hear about Newton, you hear about Maxwell. Well, actually, Newton and Maxwell were experimentalists as well. But the body of work is experimental discovery. And so, and because I played with my hands in my childhood, it's not that it wasn't bad. The theoretical incline also doesn't hurt in terms of experimental physics.
Mm-hmm. So by the time that you got to Bell Labs, which you went to after you did your PhD at Berkeley, you were actually supposed to be there as faculty, and you left to go to Bell Labs. What question were you trying to answer, and how did you come up with that question? I think that, you know, it might be interesting also to hear what question you were given that you never found an answer to.
The question I was given was, if you look, it was an astrophysics problem of two stars rotating around each other, very closely coupled, and matter would flow from one star to another star, and how you could predict how this matter would flow. So instead, what I was doing is, I love music, and I began to think, when I hear a classical passage, a violin passage, for example, very fast notes, if the violinist plays a wrong note, you can tell. But then there's a very fundamental principle in physics that says the time, the length of that note, the time you heard the note, and the frequency which you can tell what pitch it's at, are intimately connected, and the product of those two has to be greater than equal to one. And so I said, okay, if you do a quick calculation, it looks like you're doing better than that. So I set up a little test, take a tone and chopped it up and got some of my friends. And so they had an oscillator, a knob they can adjust, and so I play a tone for short bursts. They adjust the knob until, so it's not notes, so that would be cheating. And they adjust until they think, I think this is the pitch. And I got several of my friends to do this. It was remarkable. Several of my friends were tone deaf. but two of them had very, very good ears. One, in fact, was a really talented musician, and he played in the Oakland Symphony. He was a physics graduate student. And two of them could violate this fundamental principle by a factor of 10. And now it just says this is the center of the tone, and when it's really short, it sounds like a click. So I got my advisor down there and said, who's also a very talented musician, and I said, hey, what do you think of this? I showed him that. I said, you're going to publish it? He said, nah.
Oh,
I should have, actually.
Hey, I have an idea. This could be a great exploratorium exhibit.
But anyway, it was that thing that really convinced me, hey, I'm having so much fun doing things like this. Why do I want to do the other thing? Now, the question about Bell Labs, that's something. I was then made an assistant professor, despite my many failures at Berkeley. I was made an assistant professor there. But since I was spending my time there as a graduate student, and also I was a postdoc there, there was some concern that I was too homegrown. They gave me a position, but encouraged me, you could take a leave of absence for 1 or 2 years. We'll hold a position for you, or you can start your group now. Your choice. So I said, great, I'll go to I'll go somewhere else for 2 years and see the world. And so I landed at Bell Laboratories. And Bell Laboratories in those days was truly magical. When I came, my department head said, "Steve, I don't want you to immediately start on something you think you were going to start on. Take 6 months, talk to people, and get a feel for the place. And then you can decide what you want to work on." Okay. And that privilege was given to not very many people, but I remember it was in the late 70s. There was just came off an economic slump. They lifted a hiring freeze. They hired maybe 3 or 4 dozen of us within a 3-year period. They always hired young, straight out of graduate school or postdoc. They never hired established scientists. They was always young people, and it was always homegrown. And of those 30 or 40 people, 5 of us got Nobel Prizes, and a third earned the National Academy of Sciences. So it was a very magical place.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest tonight is Dr. Stephen Chu, Nobel Laureate for Physics in 1997, director of the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. Dr. Chu is discussing the Nobel Prize, Managing Science, and Solving the World Energy Crisis. So I wanted to get back to what was the question you were trying to solve, and how did you figure out that that was the question to work on?
Are you talking about the thing
at Bell Laboratories?
Oh, I worked on a whole bunch of things. I danced around.
Uh-huh.
So
the question for which you received the Nobel Prize. That work.
Okay. That started in 1983. I joined Bell Labs in 1978. I was hired to go into a branch of Bell Laboratories called Holmdel, where they wanted me to start a new, very basic research department there. And I began to talk socially with a real outstanding physicist, Art Ashkin, who had trapped particles with light since 1970 and was always dreaming of trapping atoms. Remember, this is 1983, and by that time, the work had been shut down. There was an attempt to trap atoms with light that started in the mid-70s, and it was stopped by 1979, I believe, by the director who hired me to go down there. And Art just started talking socially about it. I started thinking about it, doing some calculations, and I decided the director was right. He should have been shut down. I didn't think you were going to get there. But eventually, just through a little, you can reverse the order of things and a little change, a little tweak, and it all fell into place. So I would say that how I decided to do it was started socially, as sort of dreaming about it, and nothing, you know, like some grand vision from a long time ago. A lot of what I've done was that way, just chance encounters or chance stumbling into a new area.
So you were young when you received the Nobel Prize.
No, I was middle-aged.
Well, a lot of Nobel Prize winners get it when they're in their 70s or 80s. You were relatively young by Nobel Prize standards. Did it change your life? I mean, maybe your mother wasn't impressed, but did it make it easier to get funding?
In fact, I called her up that morning, and she didn't believe it. Yes, it did change my life. I didn't think it would change my life as much as it did. I had friends who I knew as scientists who went on to get Nobel Prizes, and I never thought differently of them. They were smart before, they were smart after. Some were dumb before, they're dumb after. Just joking. But what's different is the public reacts differently, and then you, like it or not, become a public figure. And so I didn't really appreciate that until, you know, as the years went by, I began to be, okay, you are a public figure. You have more responsibility to take care of the science enterprise of the world and so on and so forth. So it did change my life.
And you're listened to, so your opinions about all sorts of things become much more considered.
Yeah, that's too bad. Actually, when God, this is a middle-of-the-night conversation. I sort of said, well, I'm not going to talk about things I don't know about. I'll stick to things I know about. I'm hoping I'm still staying to that. So I talked about energy. So I'll actually, behind the scenes, I'm reading a lot about this problem. But yes, you are listened to. And because of that, if there are things that one feels strongly about, I think it's almost a duty to speak out in a knowledgeable way.
In the Nobel exhibition currently at the Exploratorium, there's a quote from Einstein, which I'd like to share. The mere formulation of a problem is far more often essential than its solution, which may be merely a matter of mathematical or experimental skill. To raise new questions, new possibilities, to regard old problems from a new angle requires creative imagination and marks real advances in science. Now, I'm not asking you to disagree with Albert, but I'm wondering if you talk about the role of curiosity and creativity in science.
No, I absolutely agree with what Einstein said, but I think he was not talking about, he was saying that there are a lot of smart people in the world, and picking the problem and defining the problem is the vast majority of the real new advances. And that's absolutely true. It's true in theoretical science, and it's also true in experimental science. A lesson I learned when I was a graduate student at Berkeley and looked at that time there were six Nobel laureates on the faculty, was, okay, what is it that they did what they did? Well, almost all of them were very cognizant of what was happening in technology and saying, okay, this new technical thing is happening. Can I use it to advantage in science and turn it backwards? And so this happened again and again and again about after World War II, especially the development of the radar. There was new technology. And those scientists who worked on the radar just turned it backwards and used that technology to do great things. So the trick here is to get a horse sense of where you think technology is going, and to kind of ride on the coattails, but not really on the coattails, kind of be helping develop it, but with the idea of channeling that technology back into making a completely new tool, a new set of eyes, and with this new set of eyes, you can look at old problems and solve them in a very different way. And even better, you can stumble on new problems and hopefully solve those. So it's absolutely true what Einstein said.
Bell Labs is famous for its important research discoveries. You reminded me that there's 15 Nobel laureates among its alumni. How is the culture there different? How is the culture at Bell different than university? And maybe even you can compare it with where you're at now, the National Lab.
Well, you enter at Bell Laboratories as a young Turk, if you will, and you don't have to worry about research funding. You don't have to teach classes. You are in a rich environment where the ideas are floating around in the halls. So it's the closest thing to research heaven that I know of. Universities are great, but immediately after you're hired as an assistant professor, you have to teach students, you have to raise funds, you have to do committee work, but it's a self-governing organization. At Bell Laboratories, no, you have a boss. But the boss is the boss virtually always was some of the best scientists in the place, and their job was to nurture you and provide an environment, a rich environment. So for that reason, you know, think of it, you just get good at doing science, and all of a sudden you have to pull back and be partially an entrepreneur for science. And at Bell Laboratories, you can go for 5, 10, plus 20 years doing the science with your own hands. So it is a very different situation. The other thing that's different is none of us were really allowed to grow large empires, personal empires. If you were really good, you can have a technician and a postdoc. That's it. If you wanted to do more, you had to work with others. And that really forced collaboration. In a university, I have a group right now of 20 people. 20 postdocs and graduate students. And so much of my copious spare time when I'm not running the National Lab is taking care of 20 postdocs and graduate students. Well, if you're taking care of that number of people, then you are not interacting in the same way with colleagues, not only in your department, but other departments.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest tonight is Dr. Stephen Chu, Nobel laureate for physics in 1997 and director of the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. Dr. Chu is discussing Nobel Prize, managing science, and solving the world's energy crisis.
I just want to make one, I didn't answer your question. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm hoping, actually, secretly hoping, that the Berkeley National Lab will be the replacement for the great Bell Labs, because you can have a lot of what was happening at Bell Labs. You can have staff scientists who are not encumbered with these things, mm-hmm. and you have great national facilities.
Mm-hmm. So if Bell Labs was so unfettered, so wonderful, what drew you to Stanford after 9 years of not having to write grants, not having to teach students, not having those obligations?
Well, two things. It was harder to grow old gracefully at Bell Laboratories, because there was always these young people who were really pretty good, nipping at your heels, so to speak. And maybe you can think about living off the brilliance of students. but also seriously, one thing I did miss is not having students. I always knew I wanted to be a professor and have scientific children. And at Bell Labs, you can't have scientific children. So I decided after 9 years that maybe it's time to leave and start raising a family. Now, I have more than 24, pushing 30 scientific children. Many of them are in some of the best research institutions around the world, and I should be fixed.
So now you're back at Berkeley. I imagine it's interesting to be back and actually have a question from the audience. What side of the football stadium do you sit at for the big game?
Well, I'm sort of a rascal at heart. And I remember once I was invited to attend a big game by the president of Stanford. And so this is in the press box, and all the donors were there, as well as the Chancellor of Berkeley, Chancellor Tien was also there. And I have to say, I wore blue and gold. Now, having said that, if Chancellor Bergenau invites me to the game, I might marry a cardinal.
I've read that you're a member of a pretty exclusive club, and it's not the Club of Nobel Laureates. It's something else. Can you tell us about the Steve Club?
Oh, I don't think that's that exclusive. There's a bunch of Steves around the world, Steves who've made contributions in science. And it was started by, in memory, of, if you will, of Stephen Jay Gould and of starting to show resistance to the idea that evolution was just an alternative theory to life beginning 6,000 years ago. And so all the Steves who felt that it's more than just that would sign up and say, as a Steve, after Stephen Jay Gould, we really support the idea that evolution is widely accepted by scientists. And there were, I don't know, a couple hundred, 300 or 400 or 500 Steves, and it all gets on a T-shirt in very small letters.
And do you perform skits and do things
at
meetings?
No, I don't think so. All I remember is that somewhere in my drawer there's a Steve shirt.
Do you miss doing research personally now that your time is devoted a lot to administration and talking to congressmen and running a big lab?
Actually, I hope I haven't stopped. I sneak away Friday afternoons. I don't sneak away. I tell them to clear the decks by noon or 1 o'clock Friday and the weekends. And in the, as I said, the copious spare time, I also do it. So it's actually part of me. It's so much a part of me that I it's not that I'd miss it. I don't know what it's part of me. So I love doing it, and as much as I can, I'll continue. There's a problem here because there's only 36 hours in a day, but I'm trying to figure out how to do that as well as my responsibilities at the National Lab and all the wonderful things that the National Lab is doing and can do.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest tonight is Dr. Stephen Chu, Nobel Laureate for Physics in 1997, Director of the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. Dr. Chu is discussing the Nobel Prize, Managing Science, and Solving the World Energy Crisis. So you've gotten inspiration from some interesting sources. I think we talked about some of them tonight, Yogi Berra being one. What are some of your favorite yogiisms besides what you've already?
I don't know. You come to a fork in the road, take it.
Have you taken it?
Many times. I'm hoping the world will take the right fork in the road regarding energy. Just lots of things. You can see a lot by watching. That's part of the mantra I used in the most recent work my group and I have been doing in molecular biology, using new physical techniques to develop, as I say, new eyes, watch how biochemical reactions occur one molecule at a time. Things like, I don't know where we are, we're lost, but we're making good time. It just goes on and on. So,
this is another question from the audience. What are the best energy options for developing nations, and should the U.S. try to provide guidance on energy development in these countries? Or maybe actually we're getting guidance from some of these countries. You mentioned Brazil.
I think the agricultural approach has great promise for developing countries, because that's something, once you get these plants and you get these bacteria to do this, it's a relatively low-tech solution. And so countries, especially countries in warmer climates, can take full advantage of it. It's sort of a local production of electricity. So beyond that, I think if we in the United States or the more advanced countries do develop new technologies, very inexpensive solar cells, things like that, that I hope would go out and be shared by the rest of the world. We would share that with the rest of the world.
How is it that you really started focusing on this? What was it that compelled you to choose this as the thing that you thought the Berkeley Lab should really be doing?
Well, I should be careful. I don't want the entire Berkeley Lab doing this. Mm-hmm. The Berkeley Lab can do many, many great things at the same time. But this is one thing that I think it is particularly well suited for. So, but in answer to your question, this is something that had been growing slowly over the last half dozen years. I was asked to join the board of directors of the Hewlett Foundation a couple of years ago, and the Hewlett Foundation, which is a philanthropic foundation, one of the largest in the country, it's about over $6 billion in assets, and you invest 5%, and it has a strong component in energy. And so that heightened this, and then I began to see, scientists can really make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Our thanks to Dr. Stephen Chu, Nobel Laureate for Physics in 1997, Director of the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, for joining us today. We also thank our radio audience, as well as those of you in attendance here today. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and the Exploratorium is adjourned.